Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Sarcini.
I'm Dwayne DePretis.
And I'm Chris Bernor.
Devendra Hardawar is on location at CES getting the lowdown for VentureBeat, and we hope to hear from him next week with the live report from CES and all of its goodies. And Tosin Anafoaken should be joining us momentarily. He's running a little late, but we will do a little tap dance until he shows up. This week, black boxes for cars, Intel's top secret cord cutter, an Ubuntu phone, Google makes nice with the FTC, news from the Consumer Electronics Show, and can we put an end to legalese in our EULAs? But first, we occasionally like to do a segment on the show we call What We're Playing With, where we talk about the gadgets, apps, and tech that has obsessed us over the last week. And I wanted to start with a few things. First of all, I recently tuned into this series that I literally just stumbled across. It's called H Plus, and it's produced by Bryan Singer, who of course did Usual Suspects and Superman Returns, and amongst other things. What else did he produce? The X Men. He directed at least a couple of X Men movies. This is a 48-segment YouTube series that comes in 5-minute episodes, and they're almost through their entire 48-episode run. So you could literally watch this whole series over the course of a day or two. It's set in an apocalyptic future where technology has begun to spiral out of control, and 33% of the world gives up cell phones and laptops in favor of an innovative technology that connects the internet to the human mind 24 hours a day. So there are themes in there that involve like transhumanism and internet connectivity, complete internet connectivity, like built-in heads-up devices. That it's basically like Google Glasses, but it's built inside your head instead of something that you have to wear. But the interesting thing about this is that it takes that sort of premise, and then it creates a something terrible goes awry with this technology scenario that really amps up the intensity on the show. And if you haven't seen it, I recommend it. I stumbled across this. These guys wanted to do an interview with The Drill Down when they first started, when they thought we were a print blog. But when I told them that we wanted to get them on air to do an actual interview, like an audio interview, they kind of backed out for some reason. I don't think they wanted to actually be invested in an actual audio interview. But so at the time, I kind of like ignored them. And then I stumbled across the series on my own recently, like a few weeks ago over the winter break. And I'm like, whoa, this is really good. It's probably the highest quality production value for any web series that I've ever seen, first of all.
Wow, that's saying a lot.
But so if you're in that sort of like post-apocalyptic, futuristic, high concept sci-fi thing, you'll absolutely love this.
With a little Neuromancer twist, it sounds like.
Yeah, yeah, totally, totally. So it's called H Plus, the digital series. It's on YouTube, just YouTube H Plus, and you should be able to find it. Also, over the holiday break, one of the Christmas presents that I got was the Aperture Science customizable portal device kit. Now, this is a full-size portal gun. And it's super cool. It's one of NECA, which is the I'm trying to remember what the acronym stands for. But they're basically one of the major sort of model makers, and prop replicators. Yes, and they have a whole line of Portal props already that they make, and this is one of them. It's a Portal gun that can be customized to look like either Chell's Portal gun or Atlas or Peabody's Portal gun. With included decals and snap-on plastic parts. And it has all of the associated lights and sounds that go with those three different kinds of guns. All you have to do is like flick a switch inside the where you hold it, in the handle where you hold it, and it will give you different lights and sounds depending on what switch you've got it switched to, and whether you're aiming for an open portal, for an entry portal, or an exit portal. So, but it's really cool.
It's too bad it doesn't actually make portals. That's
I know.
What I, really
I know.
Want.
It's the closest thing I can. It's the next best thing to actually being able to make portals is to have this model, this life size model.
The awesome. Portal gun is up there with flying pink hoverboard of
yep.
like things that just I need to have in my life at some point.
It's actually fairly cheap.
Flying like, pink hoverboard, really? Like you're going to go back to one of the worst science fiction movies ever. That's awesome.
But one of the cheesiest.
Yeah, that's true. That prop inspired our imaginations. I play Subway Surfer.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the hoverboards.
But if you're in the market for this portal gun is actually fairly cheap. I put it on my Amazon wish list, and it's about $115, I think. Not bad for a full size prop gun.
Yeah.
And the last thing I wanted to talk about was we'd recently talked about the Hobbit presentation in 48 frames per second, and I actually wrote an article on Geeks of Doom about some of the flaws that I noticed with the 48 frame per second presentation. And over the winter break, I went to go see The Hobbit again in a 24 frame per second 3D presentation. And I just wanted to say that all of the flaws that were inherent with the flaws that I noticed with the 48 frame per second presentation were still there in the 24 frame per second presentation, including like some of the bad makeup jobs, some of the high key lighting in some of the exterior landscape shots, and
the high key lighting for us non film geeks,
basically really hot, really bright, overly lit. Mm-hmm. Exteriors. There were some moments, some landscape shots, and some establishing landscape shots, and other outdoor scenes where it felt like they were too. It was too bright overall.
Were people complaining about flaws as in like flaws in the production of the movie? Or I felt that people were complaining about the overall experience when it comes to watchability. Because when I saw them both, I found that. I eased into the 24 a lot more easily than I eased into the 48.
Well, and some of the other complaints were like people had said that the motion felt fast. Like,
I felt that. It felt a little strange. It felt a little quick.
So watching the 24 frame per second presentation, like there was one, for example, one of the scenes that people had mentioned was a shot. Like it's literally one of the first shots of the movie. Where old Bilbo Baggins is walking down the hallway in his home, and it felt like he was waddling super fast in the 48 frame presentation. Watching the 24 frame presentation, I noticed that it didn't seem like he was any slower. He still seemed like a fast waddle down the hallway. But I will say that the 48 frame per second presentation. Made all of those inherent flaws more noticeable. So I don't think the 48 frame per second presentation was a poor presentation in and of itself, but it did highlight the already inherent flaws of the movie.
I think that's part of the
issue. That's sort of what we agreed on when we saw that like it really raises the bar in terms of the production value. Like, if you're going to do a movie in 48 FPS, you need to do a movie that literally needs to look good in every single frame.
Mm-hmm. It's the HD porn problem, guys. That's what it is. Like, well, I mean, you guys heard about it. Okay, so like back in probably like 2006, 2007, when HD was really becoming the mainstream, there was actually, I could find the article somewhere, but there was a problem. The porn industry pushed for some of these HD specifications because it always does. It has long been the heart of video technology standards, beta, VHS, that kind of thing. But some of the actresses were like, well, you know, every once in a while I get a pimple in my butt.
Yes.
And that's like a thing that you don't really notice or could be covered up with makeup in standard definition. But once you hit 720p, you know, that's in your face literally. So, you know, not that I'm some sort of aficionado or anything, but I just, it was one thing that I thought it was on. I think it was on like, PBS, like documentary or some shit. It was really funny. The HD porn problem. But yeah, this is the same sort of thing. When you have higher frame rates, higher resolutions, the flaws, the movie magic is harder to pull off. The bar gets raised and there is that problem. And there's also just the problem of, I know when I first got my Apple TV and I was looking at things for some reason, maybe it was the way stuff was encoded or whatever, things seemed to move a little faster. It was the up converting. And I realized it took me probably 2 or 3 months to get used to the up converting of DVD quality content by my Apple TV. When it tries to push it into 720p or whatever. That's just how it is. The same thing happened when I got one of those DVD Blu-ray players that up converts your DVDs. It just looked funny to me. I think people are just reacting to that, and it'll go away over time.
Yeah, I agree. Dwayne, how about yourself? What have you been playing with this week?
Oh, I've been playing with a couple things. The first tech thing I've been playing with is TuneUp for iTunes. I got this software a while ago, and I used it, and I kind of changed all my setups. So I went and downloaded the new version, and I went to use it again. And it's a software that promises a lot of things. It's going to, you know, go out to Gracenote and pull down the actual proper tags for all the songs you have in iTunes. It is an add-on to iTunes, meaning when you open up iTunes, you open up TuneUp, and TuneUp is kind of fixed against iTunes, and you can drag songs from iTunes into TuneUp for the cleanup feature. It also has a feature that goes out and looks for the album art. So it's got a database of album art, and it'll assign it to your stuff. So your cover flow looks nice on your iOS devices and your Android devices. It also worked for Windows Media Player. And then it also has this new feature. This is what I wanted to try out. Mm-hmm. The deduplication feature. And this feature promises to look inside your library, find duplicates.
Oh.
And then it promises to remove those duplicates by putting them in a folder that you specify somewhere on your hard drive. So that in the event the duplicate wasn't, you know, it's not exactly what it is, not exactly a duplicate, you can then, you can then fight it, put it back or whatever. The problem for me is that my library is apparently way too big for this feature to work successfully. It took it 2 hours to go through and find duplication. And I imagine on some level, when it comes to the known music, you know, the stuff that's been tagged properly and everything like that, it's a question of reading the files and seeing if it's the same, and then checking if and there's a little check to see if it's the same kilobyte level, the same duration of the song, things like that. So that takes a while, and it was fine. I was doing this on my Windows machine because TuneUp is tied to your machine, so it needs to be. You can't just kind of install it everywhere like you could with another modern piece of software. Mm-hmm. So I did that, and it got through like I guess my 29,000 songs or something like that. Like in a reasonable time, 2 hours or so. But then it went through the 5,000 unknown songs, like unknown artist songs,
mm-hmm.
the ones that simply can't be solved for because there's some obscure Japanese soundtrack to some anime or something like that. And it like died twice. And when I say it died, it didn't die in sort of like it's going to crash and go away. It died by telling me in a very friendly message that it was out of memory. It said, hey, we're out of memory. So that was the first time that happened. I was like, okay, it's weird. Let me close Chrome, that eats up a lot of my RAM. I have 8 gigs on that machine. So I did it again. And it came back and it said, we're out of memory. And I checked that time. It was using 1.2 gigs or something like that. So for some reason, it internally stops itself at a certain amount of memory usage. And I got to say, because it doesn't allow you to parse, as in to say, okay, only dedupe this half of my collection or this fourth of my collection or whatever, there's simply no way for this particular feature to work unless I remove my music collection and put it in a piece at a time from iTunes. So it's less than stellar right now for anyone who's out there. They're heavily advertising the new deep duplication function, and so it hasn't been the best experience for me. Anyway, on the TV show front, my girlfriend and I finally discovered Downton Abbey. It is a show in which absolutely nothing happens from episode to episode.
I can't relate because I've never seen that show, but I've heard great things about it. I'm a little surprised to hear a less than stellar review from you.
I'm not saying that I don't want to watch every episode. It's just that nothing happens from episode to episode.
It's British TV. Have you ever seen Eddie Izzard's discussion of the difference between American and British TV? Like, American TV is explosions and, you know, lots of F-bombs being thrown around, and, you know, British TV is, you know, opening doors and standing there and saying, hello, hi, you know? And that's exactly what Downton Abbey is.
Right.
So, like, it's not really first, style, if you can't tell.
First three episodes is what we've seen. No, first four episodes. And the episodes are, like, really substantive. Unlike American television, I'll say this. In an American TV show, you have an A line and a B line in terms of plot, right? Like, think of just your average TV show. There's, like, the big plot. Let's get the bad guy and the subplot of, like, the romance or something like that. On an exceptional show, like Seinfeld throw an HBO show out there, you'll find three plot lines per episode, right? Seinfeld will have something about a big salad, something about a job, and something about a girlfriend, sure, all in the same episode. Very difficult to do and keep cohesive and tie it together. I find that the British TV shows have 3 to 4 subplots per episode, which is kind of crazy. And the thing is, they're there, and things are, I guess, moving forward. It's just that there's so much time focused on the setting, kind of like Mad Men. The setting is such a big deal that you can't really move forward. Now, the characters are relatively compelling, and you want to get to know them. And at first, they all kind of look alike, partly because they're all wearing uniforms and partly because they're all British. But they're all, like, wearing maid's uniforms, right? So you're like, who's who? There's the old guy in the footman's suit, and there's the young guy in the footman's suit. Oh, the old guy's a butler. So there's a culture shock in terms of figuring out what's what. And you have to, and, like, you know, me, I'm on the Wikipedia and I'm doing all this other stuff. But, like, for a geek, looking at this show basically wants me to, like, chase down post-steampunk World War One stuff. Like, that's where the geek inspiration is right here. Like, the setting is such that it's in the Edwardian era, right after Victoria, which is the steampunk era, and it's right before the First World War. So there's a lot of, like, changes going on. The beginning of what we consider modernity, you know, people having jobs, things like that. So there's a lot in there that makes you kind of just want to, like, take a look at and do that stuff. And that really ties in well with my recent trip, because I was in India for 2 weeks, and that world is very much the high society of that country, Calcutta, New Delhi, wherever, is very much like what I see when I see Downton Abbey. So for me, it was a big, interesting cultural change. India is an amazing place. It's got technology everywhere and poverty everywhere and poverty with technology everywhere, which is something that we completely don't associate here. It's really interesting.
Chris, you wanted to you have something that you were playing with this.
This is one of my more favorite games that I got for Christmas. We've sort of gotten into sort of alternative board games. The serious one, which is really excellent, is a game called Quarto. It's this super simple matching game, sort of like Connect Four, Tic-Tac-Toe, except unlike those games, which are, you know, basically one-dimensional, either red, blue, or X's or zeros, this one is essentially four-dimensional or six or something. There's, like, all sorts of different, like, each piece in the game is unique, and matching up four of any of the same attributes, so it could be, like, circle versus square or hollow versus not hollow, But it's really, really quite an excellent game. Then the more hilarious one, which is definitely up for those of us who've spent time on places like Reddit, is this awesome card game called Flame War, a game of extreme moderation, in which you play as a... You played it?
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty stuff.
Where each player takes a role of a power-hungry forum moderator trying to control conversations on the internet.
Oh, no!
Add the threads, flame your friends, and when the time is right, close down threads to exert your awesome moderation powers.
That... Yeah, if you like that one, you should check out Cards Against Humanity.
I love that game. That is one of, probably the most hilarious...
The game of Christmas. Everyone I know.
Yeah. One of the most hilarious board card games I've ever played, I think.
I think it's for all the people who realize that the primary reason why people play apples to apples is for that time when grandma plays something like super inappropriate. and you, or at least the subsection of people who play apples to apples for, you know, the hilarious stuff that comes up, which I will not say on air.
All right. Let's get into some of our headlines here. In mid-December, Instagram updated their user agreement, and the confusing wording of the new terms of service led many users to believe they would no longer have ownership of their own photos. After much publicity, Instagram backpedaled and clarified their position with a revised terms of service agreement. TechCrunch's Josh Constein offers suggestions on how companies can avoid confusion in future TOS updates. He says, first, give a brief summary of the changes in the most accessible terms possible, the layman's explanation designed to be understood by anyone who uses your service. Second, explain every change line by line in relatively comprehensible terms. It should be the translation of the legalese into English. Third, provide a red line version highlighting the changes of the actual legally binding document. For good measure, offer a link to the old version of the documents, too. And finally, talk to the press. Don't just spring the changes and leave them open to misinterpretation. Call up a few writers before you publish the announcement or push the changes live and explain what you're doing. Listen to their questions and what they're confused about, and consider whether your announcement and documents answer these without you.
Here's the funny thing about that.
Yeah.
He, I think, incorrectly assumes that these businesses are interested in having their policies dissected by the media. I mean, it's going to happen anyway.
Yeah.
So on some level, if you're a media person, you're going to say, control the conversation, business. You know, like, be smart, control the conversation. Don't let it get out of hand. But while Instagram and Facebook have all the scrutiny on them, it's not even 80-20. I would say the vast majority of these businesses change these policies all the time without anyone noticing, because they're not under the same kind of scrutiny. So I think if these changes that he says, the red line, all that stuff, that's actually, I think it's good advice depending on what the incentive of the business is. If you want to change your model and begin to monetize your stuff and do new things and exciting things, whatever, you're going to do what any company is going to do, and you're going to slide that change under the door. And if someone notices it, then they notice it. If they don't, then they don't. The more conservative and regular, the more normal situation is to be prepared to speak about it effectively when someone finds out, as opposed to going through all these things. Because this is a lot of overhead to have people go in through the red lines in there and share those red lines. Because there are aspects of your business which you do not want to explain that are going to change your privacy policy or terms of service or whatever.
But as we've seen from the public uproar over the Instagram thing, it's obviously something that the public desires. They want reform.
Sure, and I don't disagree. What I'm saying is I don't disagree with you. I'm just saying as a standard policy across multiple businesses, this assumes a lot from the perspective of the business. It's if you know that your business is being heavily scrutinized, these measures are awesome. If it's not, or if your business has, you know, a couple motives, or you have, like, you know, suppose you have new ownership, or suppose you have you're figuring out a new way to make money or whatever, these are just not aligned with the incentive of the business. And I think that it's Apple style, right? Like, Apple will say, if you don't like it, if you don't like the fact that you can't use our products to like detonate nuclear bombs, as in their terms of service agreement, then use something else. So I don't think Instagram is where Apple is in terms of being able to tell the consumer use something else. But I do think Apple's situation doesn't fall far from the tree, to use a pun, when it comes to most other companies.
I think there's another thing going on here, and I haven't worked huge amount of time at large companies, but I think there is a bit here of the left hand not knowing what the right hand is doing type thing. Like, theoretically, at the top of the company, some level of executive should know, oh, we're doing a rewrite of the terms of service, and that's related to our strategy of doing X. And, you know, the marketing team should theoretically know that, but honestly, people tend to compartmentalize even their own work, and the PR, like, press department might not even know that there are going to be updates to the terms of service, and the legal department might be... Yeah, and like, that's not to say that there's not anything nefarious or any whatever, but like, you know, there are a variety of reasons why terms of service get updated and why, you know, what that means. It doesn't necessarily mean, you know, we're gearing up for some giant thing. It might as well just mean like, oh, we didn't like that wording. We want to fix that. Honestly, I think that, and I saw a great proposal for this, I think, on Hacker News. That basically we use version control on publicly available terms of service. So you can go back and view the history of the terms of service at any time and see what it looked like at that time.
That's great for laws. That would work, I think, really well. I think that Congress should throw that into any kind of like new law or code change in the system.
Yeah.
Like, private business is going to say, my business is private. This is not, you know.
It's the sort of thing that needs to be, like, some external party would have to enforce. Like, there would have to be a law saying, if you're going to have a terms of service, it needs to be in a format where people can view the history of it or something.
Right now, the rules are basically that each company figures out what they'll do if they change terms of service. So oftentimes, you'll read at the bottom, you'll be notified if these terms of service change. And that's because... think about it in terms of like legal risk. You don't want a million people tearing apart your terms of service. So you want to be as broad as possible with every single term. And when you change it, you want to change it and let people, and you want to have as much leverage as possible. That is to say, I'm going to let you know that it's changed. I'm not going to tell you what's changed, because it's not on me as my job as a business is to get budget out of you. You as an individual, you make X amount of dollars a year. Right. If I've got a service that costs $11 a month and I want to get more money, I'm trying to get budget out of you. I think part of what we see here is that we have a culture of young people, millennials, of which I am like the very eldest part of, who doesn't quite understand that you can't like the businesses, while they have become, I guess, more friendly or you know, their services are more social. Their main goal is still this getting budget out of you, this idea of like taking money from you. They want to give you value for that, but a lot of the tech companies start with this freemium model, we're trying to be cool and not blast you with advertising. I mean, this is the heart of Facebook, right? And as they figure out how to monetize a relatively new word that's 21st century focused, they are going to do things that are, for lack of a better term, shady. When I say shady, I mean just not in the full light of things. Not like dirty things, not sketchy things, but just not in the full light of things.
We've seen plenty of that from Instagram's owner, Facebook.
Right. So I'm saying that we have to get used to the idea that these companies are out there to make money off of us, and that it's a cigarette analogy. They get us hooked when we're young, and then they need to make money off of us. And it's part and parcel. If we want the services to succeed, they're going to need to continue to make money. Now, when they're public and stuff, they've got pressure from shareholders. They've got all these other things to do. So I'm not saying that I do think that we need to get rid of this term legalese. We should be working in plain text, and we should be working with very clear, concise modules of this is what we do with your information. This is how we advertise with your information. This is your right. These are your rights with your information. You know, I really think that that's the way to go. I've written privacy policies. I really focus on making sure things are completely clear. I've actually sent two examples to you guys of the standard thing, which is ridiculous and terrible, and what some of the newer companies are doing in terms of like laying it out and making it really clear by having the highlighted section up front. Here are the highlights, guys. We're not going to use your email address. We're not going to sell your information. We're not going to do this, or we are going to do this. We're making it clear whether we're going to do it or not. But I do think that it's important for people to understand that these policies from these companies, which are publicly traded but privately run, mm-hmm. are not the purview of the U.S. government or any other regulation body to say, hey, look, we need you to like let us know when you're changing. Like, I get consumer advocacy, but I also feel like on some level the consumer and the press need to have the responsibility of doing this and covering it. And I really think the press has done a great job with Instagram. I really think that the brouhaha is an example of a system that works. Now, do we have a reporter for every company? Yeah. Is every company? No. But I think it highlights that we need to have a functioning press that sits on top and takes a look at these material changes and asks the questions so that people can get clarification when things are noticed. That's something that people need to take charge and do a bit of looking themselves to see what they're getting into when they sign up for something.
Let me take a second here to add Tosin Onofuaken in. I think he is in now, and we'll see if he has an opinion on this before we move on to the next topic.
Hello.
Hey, hello. Tosin, how you doing?
Hey, how are you guys?
Good. I'm glad that you were able to, this podcast didn't automatically, eject you for technical reasons.
It was so weird. I've been troubleshooting this for 20 minutes or so, 25 minutes.
Oh.
it was so weird because, of course I was doing this last night, uh-huh. and not like I changed anything since leaving home and going to work.
Well, we used to say when we have a live show, we used to say that it wouldn't be a live The Drill Down without technical issues. But apparently it even occurs with recorded episodes too. So how you
this
doing?
Has been far better than Symbiotic was though. So anyway.
Well, that's good. How you doing, Tosin?
Doing well. We've got was reading a little bit of the CES stuff, so uh-huh. kind of interested to see your take on some of the articles that you have later on in the show. And also I have a hackathon coming up at work tomorrow, so
oh wow.
24 nice. Hours with colleagues. That's gonna be fun.
Holy smokes.
Have anything planned for that, or can you not tell us?
I'm going to be working on a few things. It's more just leveraging our APIs and making some cool things for our customers. We'll see how far we come along because I'm also trying to learn Python, Django, and use Bootstrap all at the same time. Oh, wow. So it'll be fun. It'll definitely be fun. But our hackathon is James Bond themed. So,
oh boy! Oh, that should be fun. I would love to see what comes out of that.
Yep, I'm actually going to be screening a movie during part of it, so I'll be screening Casino Royale.
Ah, terrific, terrific film. Yeah, except for the part where James Bond gets it in the balls.
Yeah, yeah. I do without that. Plus, I actually just got a projector from work, which I need to test out here in my apartment. Because I, in our section, so I'm part of professional services, mm-hmm. I'm usually when I work on projects, or usually when a lot of us work on projects, you have music or even films and stuff in the background. So we're going to have a screen projecting entertainment,
nice.
All sorts of movies and TV series.
That sounds like a really fun time, actually.
Yeah, no, I think it's going to be awesome.
Well, let's move on to our next topic here, Tosin. Just to catch you up, we just finished talking about the need to put policy changes for end user license agreements or terms of services into layman's terms, and let's move on here to black boxes in cars. So, federal regulators are proposing that new automobiles sold in the U.S. after September 2014 come equipped with black boxes, or so-called event data recorders that chronicle everything from how fast a vehicle was traveling, the number of passengers, and even a car's location. Clearly, the regulators' intentions are about safety, as the devices would trigger for about 30 seconds during so-called events such as sudden braking, acceleration, swerving, or other types of driving that might lead to an accident. But privacy advocates are raising the alarm bells and want the agency to require data safeguards, including demands that data be anonymized and to prohibit the marketing of it. What do you guys think about this? I personally feel like this is a – I think especially when we get into the world of driverless vehicles, I think something like this is going to be more necessary. However, I think it's on its own, it's a great idea. It's something that I feel like it's one of those technological advancements that like is so obvious that it should have happened a long time ago.
Dude, totally. I mean, this is one of those things where, first of all, let's take a quick look and just, when it comes to privacy policies, yeah, this is totally where this applies, right?
Yeah.
This is like, yeah, this is one of those things where you have to, like, the user has to be made abundantly aware of what's being recorded, how it's being recorded. And when I say what's being recorded, yeah, they're talking about, oh, the car swerved and then it was going this many meters per second or whatever. We also need to know, is it recording the audio in the car? Is there any visual recording? Is there, I mean, what's going on? They know that they're looking to see how many people are in the seats. So it's recording like the weight of the individuals. Like, how's that working? People need to understand that. This, I think, especially for Chris, is an example where the government already regulates the sale, manufacture, use, and safety of automobiles. So this is where any kind of privacy change would necessarily need to have that red line, that kind of very exposed layout of whether or not it's, you know, what's happening here, how's it being different. Frankly, I think that if you have a data recorder in a car, there's almost no reason why in a smart grid it shouldn't be on all the time. It shouldn't be on and transmitting anonymous usage statistics to car manufacturers so they can make their cars more efficient, more quick. They can understand when people are braking normally, when people are like accelerating more, which highways and byways are being used more frequently, how they're being used more frequently, and, you know, pass that data on to those who deal with traffic patterns and trying to make traffic better. Mm-hmm. I think the data will, you know, the data will save us all. So I don't really see, I get the privacy concerns here, but I really feel as long as it's anonymized and we lock down what it can be used for, not advertising clearly, things like that, but for real, like, transportation purposes and things like that, I think this is a great first step forward, especially when it comes to traffic. How awesome would it be if you could tell Google Maps style that there's a traffic jam ahead of you because they're transmitting the data that says all these cars are moving at 5 miles an hour?
Yeah, I kind of agree entirely with that. So one thing that's important about this to understand is this technology, at least initial version of it, is already on a great number of cars. If I remember properly, something like 97% of cars already have these sort of like black boxes for cars on them. So like this is more like taking something that's already there and, you know, pushing it forward. I totally agree on the privacy policy thing. I certainly think that, you know, this, you know, the questions for law enforcement, the questions for, you know, companies, the questions for privacy, that is somewhat scary about this. That being said, like, I have this sort of philosophy of technology that we need to fix the problems with new technology rather than simply rejecting it because it's new. Like, I think it's easy to, like, look at, you know, well, here's a good example of something. Mm-hmm. We look at something like oil, and we look at the problems of having a petroleum-based economy, and we're like, oh my gosh, oil is so bad. You know, why did we ever switch to it? And then we forget that, well, by switching to petroleum, we saved the whales, because before petroleum, whales were the biggest source of oil, and if we had continued to go with them, we would have hunted them out. And the amount of positive, you know, goodness that can come out of tracking, you know, cars and tracking safety and tracking, you know, what happened in an accident is just huge. Eliminates so much of what is essentially guesswork in you know, accidents and fixing cars and all that sort of stuff. So I'm, you know, excited to see it because I think it'll be good. We just need to, as always, ensure that we keep it. What am I trying to say? That we
We take protect care. Ourselves. Yeah, we take care. Yeah. Protect the individual. Because the thing is, you don't even need, like, the thing about data and data usage and data statistics is that you're really looking not for an individual's data. You need a set of data that is the more massive, the better.
Sure.
The larger the sample, the better. And that necessarily protects consumers because you don't need to know who they are. You don't need to know if, you know, they're male or female, you know, Asian, black, whatever. You don't need to know that when it comes to what they're trying to record here. You know, could they specifically later on try to determine trends based on, like, culture or whatever? Maybe. But really what we need to know is, you know, how the cars are moving on the road, what sort of problems the cars have on the road. And if you look at the high-end cars like Bugattis and things like that, when those cars actually have problems, they send text messages to their manufacturing stations so that the cars can the mechanic will call you up and say, hey, we found out that your car has this issue. Let's fix it before it becomes something big. Obviously, mm-hmm. on a vehicle like that, fixing is very expensive, so you want to catch it early. In fact, I was in Denver once, and there was a Bugatti Veyron, you know, 1,000 horsepower car sitting there. And the guy was sitting on the curb in front of it. He's like, I can't move it because it turned itself off because it has a problem. And it automatically texted the local shop, and it turned itself off until they can get here with the tow truck because it doesn't want to hurt itself.
Amazing.
So
it's also surprising they have a local shop.
Well, yeah, Denver and Boulder. But yeah, so it's that's like a thing. Like, as cars get smarter, we really have to depend on their connectedness to have us get the most out of them.
Yeah. That being said, one really big problem with cars is that a lot of car manufacturers are simply not used to thinking about security within cars. And the communications network that the various parts of the car use to communicate with themselves is... There have been some pretty scary demonstrations by security researchers of how easy it is to hack into a car, sometimes with physical access, sometimes with just being near enough the car to pick up the wireless signals that the various computers on board are using to communicate with each other. Mm. And you know, this thing compounds it. The more information you're collecting and the more you have, the more you're going to... The more there is to break, and the more, you know, points there are for the, you
points
know,
to failure.
Attacker yeah. to come in. Yeah.
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 I mean, as they said, with great power comes great responsibility. So I think there definitely should be
you
certain rules
Spider-Man?
In place. Yes, I just did. There definitely should be rules in place. But I think it is, I think the, I was about to say, I think the ends justify the means. No, I definitely think that it would improve. It could do a lot of things to improve everyday lifestyle. Simply put, it will also help regulate certain things a little better too. And who knows? Maybe these black boxes would also come into play when we do get into automated driving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's what Andy's big point was: the automated driving. Now, I mean, law enforcement, things like that, like. There was that state employee in Massachusetts. This was a monitor in one of the stories that we looked at for this particular piece segment. And he got in a car accident, and it turns out that according to that black box, despite his story, the black box came out and said that it was he was traveling at over 100 or up to 100 miles an hour, over 100 miles an hour, and he was possibly asleep. I don't know how they figured that out.
Yeah,
when the car crashed.
That came off a little strange to me. He said he was going a lot slower, and then the black box said he was going over 100 miles. He was going 100 miles per hour without a seatbelt on.
Yeah, without a seatbelt.
And like, I'm very curious the damage you would see with a car if you slammed into someone at 100 miles per hour. Plus, I'm also very surprised that
he walked away from it without a scratch.
Exactly. So yeah. It makes you kind of question. I wish, you know, that article had been able to include photos of the vehicle and, you know, police written report, because that's pretty nuts.
And this goes to the heart
of
what,
rant
this goes,
here.
Wait, can I just want to say one thing? This goes to the heart of what this stuff says. The writer on Wired, the threat level article that we read, they asked that, you know, if this is going to be a standard, and it should be a standard, that the software, the code for the software, be made available so everyone understands, you know, it's not proprietary. and everyone understands what's being recorded, how it's being recorded, and how the computer is dealing with it. That way, you have so many more minds looking at the software and updating the software and thinking like that, that there's no question as to the veracity, the peer-reviewed veracity. That's what this level of open sourcing, it's peer review. Just like with all science that we do, when you get something like, you know, in the Journal of American Medical Association, they want, they're calling for a peer-reviewed way of looking at the code so that we can all agree that when things says it was at 100 miles an hour and the guy wasn't wearing a seatbelt, you know, we're all in agreement that it's a standard that we care about, instead of Ford saying, well, our system does it differently, and Toyota saying their system does it differently. So I think that's that's a key piece of what needs to happen in terms of regulating this properly. But I'm sorry, Chris, what were you going to say?
Yeah, no, well, that was sort of along the lines of what I was going to go into. But bigger rant, I don't, this is more rant than anything that I have a proper solution for. The thing that always worries me about these sorts of devices, especially devices that have like rise to sort of affect legal cases, the sort of mindset that I think we have about what those devices can do and what they do. I mean, we can collect huge amounts of awesome information, and we can collect awesome amounts of, you know, information via these things. But I think that, like, you know, it's nothing like NCIS. And yet I feel like when you go to a courtroom and you say, ah, this black box measured this happening, then the jury is very likely to be like, ah, well, it's technology, it must be true. Those of us who've worked with technology know that, you know, when the device is telling you something that can't possibly be the case, it's usually something wrong in the device. It's not that you found some ridiculous, you know, thing. And I just sort of worry about, like, I think it's just
the lack of common sense that shows up when people.
Yeah, and I really think that we, like, as, you know, geeks, need to push back on the public perception of what technology is capable of, what it's not capable of, what it can be used for. You know, because I feel like for many people, the primary, you know, view of what technology can do and can't do comes from, you know, enhance, you know.
What Chris is referring to is when you watch a TV show or movie and they've got some video screen and someone says, oh, I can't see it, can the computer enhance it? That kind of magic isn't always apparent. The computer isn't all-knowing and all-seeing. It takes people and it takes judgment.
Yeah. Right. So that was my sort of side rant about us being good, I would say netizens, except really just humans now.
All right, let's move on here before we get too bogged down. We got still a bunch of stuff to cover. Dwayne, you brought up this next topic to our rundown here. In Michigan, getting a hold of current and potential employees' social media account information just got a little bit more difficult. The state has passed a law so citizens will be judged on skills and dedication to their work rather than their party picks or status updates. The law outlaws teachers and parents from asking employees and school children for login information to access their social media accounts. The bill is the Internet Privacy Protection Act, and it gives citizens the right to refuse surrendering their username or passwords for social media sites such as Facebook and Twitter. Does this count for just outlaws teachers? Is it just for children? Not just for children. This is across the board for all citizens.
Yeah, that's the idea. The idea is that you should be able to maintain your – just because your private life is online doesn't mean that your private life is now part of your professional life. So the idea is that there were reports of some companies saying, great, you look good, but, you know, we have a certain type of person we like to hire. We have to make sure you're a good fit. We need to log into your Facebook. That was part of their vetting and investigation. Their investigation of the individuals, and users in an economy where people are desperate for jobs are like, okay. Despite the fact that it flies in the face of a lot of what we talked about here tonight regarding privacy, this is a very privacy focused episode. And you know, there were some people who said, hey, look, this is a bad idea. There's no reason why, you know, the fact that I'm drunk. Someone took a picture of me drunk on the curb with my panties showing, should be something my employer gets to judge me on. So just like how you can, you have to think about what's on Facebook. You have to think about, you know, who can see what. Is everyone able to see your stuff or just your friends? Are you letting anyone tag you, or do you have to approve your tags? On the flip side, you know, as that has happened, as Facebook has worked to make the privacy features more robust, businesses have been like, well, I used to be able to just look and see whatever I wanted to see. I still want to see that. Give me your password. And what Michigan's decided to do is say, no, that's not okay. When someone, you know, everyone has the right to do whatever the hell they want when they're in their personal life. And you've got to like, you know, base your merits on their professional existence, not on what you can scrounge up by looking at their private Facebook stuff or their private Instagram stuff or their you know, Netflix watch list or whatever. So I think it's pretty significant in setting the tone for how our culture wants to mm-hmm. deal with these sorts of issues. I think the private-public divide has become really muddled in our current social media atmosphere. And while people have to be responsible about themselves, I think we also have the this is basically saying that we have the right to maintain our privacy no matter who we want to share it with, which is the right to say no. You should be able to share whatever you want with anybody you want and only with whoever you want. And I think that's what Michigan's saying. So I'm pretty excited about this ruling.
Yeah, if only that it can be a precedent that's set for other businesses out there. Hopefully it will.
Well, the way common law works is that in America we have, you know, we have laws that are based on statutes and laws that are common law. Common law is basically what happens when someone says they're in a courtroom and there's an issue to be decided, and someone says, well, this other court over here decided it this way, mm-hmm. and I want to use it as a precedent. And the judges will say, oh, well, because of that precedent,
right.
I'm going to work to affect that.
We're not reinventing the law here. We're just, you know, applying a law that has already been applied
exactly.
somewhere else.
Exactly. So let's hope that this trend catches on state to state.
All right.
It's also somewhat for the protection of the employers. Like, this is a terrible strategy. I mean, I'm not a huge expert on HR law, but I know that there are a number of things that you're not allowed to turn down or hire an employee based on, you know, religion, sex, age, et cetera. And, you know, giving access to somebody's social media like immediately gives you access to all sorts of stuff that you do not want to know, because once you know their age and sex and everything, you can't prove that you didn't turn them down because of that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a really great point from like a conservative and business perspective. It protects the employer from, you know, having a hardcore HR person, you know, over vet, so to speak.
Yeah, exactly.
But from the other perspective, have you guys have heard of the, I think it's a site and company called Clout?
Yeah.
Clout. Yeah.
Right. So that kind of takes it to the other level. Now, it's not necessarily, I haven't used it, so I don't believe it really exposes too much that you can't get freely. That's already not there. But some companies are already, you know, basing people's employment on their
Clout,
you know,
score?
Internet influence, so to speak, right? Yeah, based on their Clout score.
Well, that's appropriate in some cases, right? So, like, I think the difference is, you know, Clout is something I sign up for. Davinja signed up for it. And it does some weird normalization across your Twitter and Facebook and other presences to determine where your internet pushes. And you can expose those results to other people or not. I think if you're moving toward a media-focused job, that's a legitimate job requirement. Now, that picture of you like kissing that girl at that party, or that picture of you just like red-faced because you drank too much or whatever, that's what this is protecting against. It's not protecting against that the sort of layout of how you gauge yourself across the web. If you have, I mean, Clout lays out whether you have what your level of influence is, and the type of influence you have. Oh, this person's really big into, I don't know, technology. This person's really big into fashion or something like that. So if you're really big into something that's like randomly inappropriate, you may not want to share your Clout score, but you might want to promote your Clout score if it's a massive one. Just like how you get on LinkedIn. That's what Clout is. It's a LinkedIn type of thing. How you get on LinkedIn and you seek out references, recommendations, and then you position those when you look for employment. So I feel like it's a very good point, like this whole Clout score and like where your internet presence is and everything. But it's something that I think is more linked to the LinkedIn, which is focused on this sort of thing. And in fact, I think that today it's hard to get a job in digital anything if you don't have like a pretty reasonable LinkedIn presence. Isn't that weird? So you need social media on some level. You try to hide it on a level.
All right. moving on here. Last week, the Federal Trade Commission reported that Google has agreed to change some of its business practices to resolve FTC concerns that those practices could stifle competition in the markets for popular devices such as smartphones, tablets, gaming consoles, as well as the market for online search advertising. In response to the agency's concerns about several of its business practices, Google has agreed to take the following steps. They will not seek injunctions to block rivals from using patents essential to key technologies, and they will remove restrictions hampering advertisers' management of their ad campaigns across competing ad platforms. The FTC concluded an extensive investigation into allegations that Google had manipulated search algorithms to unfairly promote its own competing vertical properties, and concluded that universal search, as well as additional changes made to Google's algorithms, even those that may have had the effect of harming individual competitors, could be plausibly justified as innovations that have improved Google's product and the experience of its users. Many people thought the FTC let Google off easy, including Microsoft, whose general counsel was, quote, puzzled and concerned that the FTC did not follow its standard practice in exercising due diligence by obtaining feedback from the industry on the specific matters of Google's promise before accepting it as a suitable resolution of this matter, end quote. Do you guys feel that Google was let off easy by the FTC? Should there have been a sort of deeper investigation into search bias?
This is kind of weird, right? Because, well, I mean, I don't know, kind of weird, but I guess Microsoft is like, wow, this is awkward. So you're saying that if I put an address bar in my task, an address field in my task bar in Windows 98, that I am necessarily like antitrust?
Yeah.
But Google adding its social stuff into its search results is not antitrust? Yeah. I don't get it. And I think that many a layperson, or even like a legal professional in this case, would look at it and be like, I don't get it. And frankly, I don't think I get it.
Yeah. I think what it boils down to is like people feel better about Google than they did about Microsoft when Microsoft was doing a lot of that stuff. And so Google seems like it can get away with more. Now, let me say, that's not how the law is supposed to work.
Right.
But it does seem like that's how it is working in this case.
Exciting. Does that mean to you, Chris, that, okay, think about it this way. Microsoft, super business focused, you know, business necessity. Google, life focused. Everybody needs Google, not just when you're at work, but when you're at home. So you think that's one of the reasons why the FTC maybe was is appearing to be more lenient? Or do you think it has maybe something to do with the fact that they may have screwed up the Microsoft issue and they're using that knowledge and learning to and applying that to Google?
Knowledge and learning? What? No, I think it's more the, you know, more the former, that of course I think people see Google in a much better light in terms of, you know, the little fun and quirky things they do as an organization. Google is this sort of place. Even if you just go to their website, right? If you go to google.com and the various things they do for the anniversaries, occasions, birthdays, the little slight modifications which just make them seem as a much more friendlier company. And so I think that perception, and of course, because Google surrounds us in all their applications and integrations, that perception, you know, seeps into your everyday life. And it's the same sort of case where, you know, as a juror, you're supposed to be impartial, but and that's why they lock you away in a room away from, you know, all things associated with the case. Well, I don't think there's much de-association here for the people making the decisions above. At least that's my perception.
You think this might be an issue of – so one more question. You think this might be an issue of – it's easy to understand where Microsoft perhaps overstepped its bounds with the integration of Internet Explorer. But it's more difficult for that same set of regulators, possibly a new generation of regulators that was 10, 15 years ago. It's – the Google products that are more that are newly integrated that have caused this brouhaha are possibly far more subtle or far more abstract. So the issue isn't as apparent or isn't as blatant, so to speak. Could that be what's going on here too?
It's an interesting point you make because I think that this really is sort of a an indication of a bellwether change from between now and when Microsoft had their injunction, monopoly accusations from the Justice Department. I think it's both an indication of the change in the particular type of situation where it's something software that's built into an operating system versus results that are supposedly built into a search engine's algorithm, and also the difference between back then, which was I don't even remember how many years ago that was, versus now. So I think there's definitely a change in. I think if Microsoft were to, if Bing were to fall into the same set of circumstances, that it would be judged the same as Google was now. I don't think that the FTC would be any harder on Bing if they were accused of search bias as Google was today with the FTC's ruling.
Oh, okay. So you're opting for the more like it's a different world.
Yes. Yes.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't really know what to say about this particular thing. It just seems on its surface, I can understand completely why Microsoft is so frazzled. Mm-hmm. I would maybe not frazzled, but confused, upset, unhappy. But I feel like, you know, Google, personally, when I saw my Google Plus results in my search, the first thing I did was turn it off. But then again, we talked about this earlier. When it comes to software, I don't like changes. I don't like the new shit. I like to vet things before I use them. I'm the same guy who turned off instant search on my browser. But yeah, I can totally see why this is a... I hate that shit, instant search.
In short, that's your capsule assessment of the situation.
All right. It's like I'm typing. I'm like, let me finish. You don't know. You don't let me finish. It's like when I'm at a restaurant and I'm not done drinking my glass of water and someone comes to refill it. Oh.
That's how you really feel.
Let's talk briefly about one more headline here before we get into our main topic this week, which is some of the CES announcements. So Wall Street Journal reports that for the past year or so, Intel has been quietly working on a top secret set-top box that could not only be better than what Apple, Google, or even Microsoft have today, but also kill the cable industry as we know it. The set-top box, said by industry insiders to be available to a limited beta of customers in March, will offer cable channels delivered over the top to televisions anywhere there is an internet connection, regardless of provider. For the first time, consumers will be able to subscribe to content per channel, unlike bundled cable services, and you may also be able to subscribe per show as well. Leveraging the speed of current broadband and the vast shared resources of the cloud, Intel plans to give consumers the ability to use, quote, cloud DVR, a feature intended to allow users to watch any past TV show at any time without the need to record it ahead of time, pause live TV, and rewind shows in progress. Now, since this Wall Street Journal article, further reports claim that this product may be mired in the fact that Intel is having trouble getting content providers to sign on, which does not surprise me one bit. What did you guys think of this?
I mean, I'm glad that Intel's trying to figure something out, right?
Like, yeah.
That's cool. But at the same time, I really feel like this is a... It's clear it's not a vaporware product because the money that's being reported.
Mm-hmm.
But I really feel like we kind of have to just wait and see.
A lot of people have been saying, you know, hey, just let me purchase my show. Just let me purchase, you know, my particular station.
Yeah.
For me, as a sports fan.
a la carte.
Right. People have been wanting that for a long time.
The question is, A, how much is it? And B, if it is, you know, pretty expensive, or when it does come out, will people, you know, now that it's provided, will people jump ship and be able to and go forward with it? I mean, in theory, it sounds pretty awesome, but there's the whole practicality portion when it actually comes out.
It's, you're right, Tosin. It's concept versus execution. And I think what I've seen some stuff that's shown that people are actually willing to pay more money to just get what they want. It's the difference between watching TV and watching your show. The Netflix advantage is to say, I'm not sitting there clicking through a million channels and getting mired up in like junk and nonsense. I'm going to watch a show. I'm going to watch, for instance, Downton Abbey's first season on Netflix, and that's what I'm going to watch. I mean, that 5 or 16 hours, like whatever, how many hours that show is, that's all I'm going to see. I'm paying the extra money because I don't want to be wasting time with the commercials. I don't want to waste time flipping through the channels and just kind of couch surfing or couch potato or whatever. I just want to see what I want to see. They say it seems that people are willing to pay more for that experience. Now, if you're a cable company, though, you're getting paid on your commercials, and you're able to pay out on your commercials. It's the reason why HBO Go is not available to the general consumer. It's only available to those people who have a cable package and have added HBO. Because right now, the economics for those – this is why Andy probably wasn't surprised about what Intel was saying, how difficult it is to get these content deals. The economics aren't in favor of the a la carte when it comes to the actual content provider, the person making the content. Cable still has this great – I'm not going to call it a stranglehold, but let's say a gilded lily to give to people who work within their ecosystem, because there's so much other stuff subsidizing their product, their super massive TV, hard to manage, muddle through a product, that you can't help but having a secure income as a content provider like HBO if you're going through cable instead of going a la carte.
Let us take a little break here before we get into our main topic. We're going to talk a bit about our sponsor, which is Audible.com. Now, for the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book that I'd like to recommend this week is The Wonderful Wizard of Oz. It's the L. Frank Baum classic novel. This one is narrated by Anne Hathaway. It's part of Audible's A-list connection. have you heard this one already, or
Well, The Wizard of Oz has got to be my favorite kids book.
Yeah,
I recently watched The Dark Knight Returns again, or Rises again, and I can't get over Anne Hathaway. I think she's actually got a really good speaking voice.
Uh-huh.
I just think of her in the Catwoman outfit. I see her reading this book, and I'm like, wow.
Reading it in a cat outfit—that's awesome.
Better than Halle Berry, right?
Yeah. Oh God, yes. Yeah. She does not need to be in a costume anytime soon for anything. They've been doing this with a lot of. This is their A-list collection, so they've been doing this with people like Elijah Wood and who else?
Will Wheaton.
Will Wheaton, but he's not
Will Wheaton,
but he's not specifically part of their A-list series. Although in my mind, he's an A-list reader. This is one of the classic novels of English literature, of American literature, English language American literature, and probably one of the best sort of applications of Joseph Campbell's hero's journey ever. And if you haven't read the L. Frank Baum book, it's tons more entertaining, I feel, than even the famous 1939 movie with Judy Garland.
It is a phenomenal book.
Yeah.
And it's actually interesting because this is the book that you hear about L. Frank Baum. He's the guy who also L. Frank Baum, he's a great writer. He also wrote like 11 or 9 other Oz books.
Mm-hmm.
One of the first big ecosystem universe series. And these books, they don't all have to do with Dorothy. He creates new characters.
Sure.
And there's like the raggedy doll girl of Oz and like Ozma of Oz. And you can, I, as a kid, I think I was maybe 9 or 10 when I really got into Oz. After his 11 books, a person named Ruth Pumley Thompson wrote about 30 more. So Oz goes on forever. And this is like the best introduction, obviously, and it's standalone and it's wonderful. But if you've got a kid or you just want to rediscover it yourself, this is definitely something that's worthy of a listen.
Yeah, if I'm not mistaken, because I've read a few of these books to my daughter, I think this may be the only, like most of the rest of the Oz series books take place with characters who are indigenous to Oz.
Exactly.
I think this is the only one where it takes an outsider from the world and introduces an outsider into Oz. And Dorothy Gale is there to kind of represent our the reader in that stranger coming into a strange land aspect. So
exactly, there's one more guy who's there are a couple guys who are from outside. Obviously, the wizard, but Ojo in Oz is another one. It's a Plumlee Thompson book. I think it's from like 1960 or 70 or 50 or something like that. It's from the middle 20th century. Another phenomenal one. I mean, it's, you know, imagine an island that can fly with a humongous magical umbrella on top of it, and what that does with your imagination. Wow. So these books are great, and I kind of hope that they use these Audible as a platform to get more of these properties out there, because this is the kind of thing where you can be in the car with your kid, or you can be in the car by yourself and just get transported to something that's a bit more light than our typical normal everyday, you know, world.
One thing I really like about Audible is that they're really good about sort of organizing a book series. So, you know, in their individual sort of pages for each of these books, they'll also have a link that lets you browse the entire series of whatever book series the book is part of by the books that they have on in audio format. So the Oz series is one of them. Although I see on their page here, there's a lot of repeats because they have a lot of versions of The Wizard of Oz, in case you're interested.
I'm sure, yeah.
Okay, so to download that free audiobook, this is the most important part of this whole discussion of this. Go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for your free audiobook. And going to that site helps our show. When you go to their site and sign on with Audible at audibletrial.com/thedrilldown, we get a little bit back helping us out. So that is you can have that free audiobook download of The Wizard of Oz or any of Audible's other 100,000 plus titles, plus the free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. That's audible.com, audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. So we're going to take a little break, listen to some music, and when we come back, we're going to talk about some of the highlights of CES so far. So take a listen to this and come on back. You know your culture from your trash. You know your plastic. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas, Christopher Bernor, and Tosin Anifowakin. And let's talk about CES, which is the Consumer Electronics Show held in Vegas every year about this time. It's a chance for product manufacturers to trot out their flagship devices for the year to come and set trends with a sneak peek at devices with no specific release dates. We're not there this year. Devendra is. But since it's one of the tech world's most covered events, we were able to do some armchair exploration. Let's talk about just a small handful of some of the major things announced at CES. This week, Canonical took the wraps off the mobile version of Ubuntu, which is built around the existing Android kernel and drivers. It supports both ARM and x86 processors. The Ubuntu phone OS will be compatible enough to let Android phone makers run it on their devices with minimal adaptation. From an overall design perspective, Ubuntu looks to offer a pretty dynamic home screen experience that's quite a bit different from Windows Phone, Android, or iOS. It's focused more around recently used content, like contacts you've spoken to recently, music you've added, and apps you've used, rather than a static grid of content. Now, Chris, I've been dying to hear your your impressions on this since you're our in-house like Linux expert. And I saw Canonical's little like presentation that they had. It was a it wasn't a live presentation, but it was a pre-recorded presentation where the president of Canonical sort of walked through the new Ubuntu OS. I was wondering, did you get a chance to see that?
I did not get to actually watch it, but I have been following the rise of Ubuntu for Android. I don't know what to call it, because this is a separate product which they have, which is Ubuntu for Android, mm-hmm. but this is like Ubuntu, the operating system that can run on your phone. If that sort of makes sense. I can't remember. I get the branding confused. Honestly, this is – so put this in perspective. I have no preconceived ideas about somehow Linux, you know, taking over, you know, the for-profit, for-pay, you know, consumer world. It's pretty late for a newcomer to be coming to the mobile market, and I mean, if they can move in, then that would be great. I'm not, you know, it's not a bad thing that they're moving in, but I'm not terribly like baking my hopes on them suddenly, you know, taking over the phone market.
Right. But they don't pose a threat to Google Android or iOS, is what you're saying.
Not in my opinion that much. However, there are two things about this that I am super excited about. First of all, I have been a little bit worried about sort of the direction that with the sort of going away of, you know, traditional laptops for lots and lots and lots of people, like it does seem like desktop Linux is looking a little bit less relevant. Like it's basically literally only for you know, nerds and whatnot. Whereas, you know, you could have made the argument a few years ago that desktop Linux was at least moving towards the place where it could be used by just about anybody for a low-cost operating system. But having a mobile operating system for a phone means that they're not far away from having a mobile operating system for a tablet too, which I think is probably more exciting. Mm-hmm. The ability to have Ubuntu on a tablet is pretty exciting. I'm pretty excited about this. I actually might even use it when it comes out. As you guys know, I have very mixed feelings about both Android and iOS. And one thing that's sort of been frustrating me about it is that like most Linux tools, like most of the tools that I use on a daily basis could seriously run on my phone. Like, I don't need heavy power and everything. And I think the idea of having a device that can be either a phone or a desktop device mm-hmm. is just kind of mind-boggling. Like, I love the idea of, like, just walking into work, plugging my phone into a dock, having that dock be, you know, connected to my big monitor and my big keyboard, and just instantly being on my desktop and being able to, you know, access my files and access stuff and then, you know, go back and use it for phone calls when necessary too. I think that is just super cool. Like rather than carrying around a separate laptop, separate whatever, like this is literally one device that can do everything.
That's the dream.
Is that sort of what Microsoft was aiming for with the Windows 8 with the Metro user interface. They wanted, like, they basically, even the Windows 8 kernel, like the Windows 8 kernel was supposed to be universal across multiple platforms as well.
Yeah, I think they were, but they didn't. I think they're sort of getting at that more with their tablet than their phone. But I think having it be the tablet rather than the phone does sort of change things. I mean, like, the fact that you can literally keep this thing in your pocket and then use it for real work is kind of, I think, the genius of it.
And it's only possible because the cloud is available and like mature now, you know, like the idea that it's also going to back itself up. So if you lose it, you're not shit out of luck.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, in this case, like, I think this is just the technology we have with phones now. Is it small enough, powerful enough phones? I mean, like, you know, I look at my laptop that I'm recording this on is a 1.3 gigahertz ultralight model, probably, I don't know, which is probably less powerful than the A4 on my iPhone, like, when you really get right down to it. It seems like, you know, the phones are powerful enough that they can actually do quite a bit of computing power, and we just need to give them the appropriate connections and the appropriate operating system to do that. And I also kind of like the idea of having like a full-fledged open source competitor on this platform. I mean, like, right. The closest thing you have right now is, I guess, CyanogenMod, which is the sort of open source fork of stock Android. I mean, that's sort of one funny thing about Android. Android is technically open source, but, you know, up until now, even on the Nexus devices where you're getting vanilla Android, that version is not open source. That is Google's version, and there's all sorts of Google-specific stuff in there, which they're certainly not going to be sharing with anybody. Right. So to have an operating system that is truly open source and to have that option, I find... my hippie ways. That makes me happy.
Anybody else want to chime in on their thoughts on an Ubuntu OS, phone OS?
Hey, I mean, it is... Oh, go ahead.
Saying if Windows popped in a little while ago, I feel like this... And they still have hope. I feel like, you know, the more the merrier. Like, we just need more. We need more OSs, more competition, all that stuff.
It's definitely good for competition. I would say... what I find is most relevant nowadays is really the ecosystem with the device. So we'll see what that brings about as far as the Ubuntu phone goes.
Yeah, like, I mean, like, how are they going to attract developers? Microsoft has this problem right now with Windows 8 mobile stuff. They think they solve for that by trying to, like, link the SDKs. But, you know, what are they going to do to make it so that we... you know, the guys, the girls, the programmers are tied in and want to develop applications for this, you know? Or is it going to be able to emulate certain other things that we have on desktop operating systems? To Chris's point about, you know, wanting to, like, the chips and how, like, his phone's computing power might, you know, rival his desktops, are the phones using 64-bit chips, or are they still on 32? Or, like, how does that work? Does anyone know?
I don't know.
Yeah, because I feel like one of the reasons why this era of smartphones is different is for two reasons to me. One is because the chips are native the chips are low power. They're these ARM low power things. Mm-hmm. And because the operating systems are designed specifically for these chips, as opposed to, like, you know, Windows Mobile, which forever was a port of Windows on a mobile device. That and the use of apps in a cohesive, easy to get way. So I feel like if Ubuntu can get those three things together, they can get hardware, they can get their software to run in a way that feels native to this hardware. That's just not a port. We feel good about that. If they could get the app development, we'd be really good about that. And then finally, if they can make sure that the computing power is tight and tied in and useful and used efficiently, we'll feel good about that.
All right. Okay, let's move on here. So another one of the things, this was just crazy. I saw this and I kind of blew my mind a little. So NVIDIA unveiled Project Shield, which is a gaming controller / portable console running the just announced Tegra 4. The controller looks similar to a PlayStation 3 DualShock 3, although with a HD screen attached. And the HD screen, like, can fold up. Like, all of the actual, like, controls are recessed in the device so that the screen folds over and it's completely flush on top. NVIDIA's promising 38 hours of gaming, 5 to 10 hours of gaming.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry. 5 to 10 hours of gaming and 24 hours of HD viewing out of the 38-watt rechargeable lithium-ion batteries built in. A swanky audio system on par with Jamboxes, is their quote, on par. A full-on Android gaming experience. A micro SD sits next to an HDMI output, a USB port, a standard 8-inch audio jack, directly below the customizable 5-inch Retina display touchscreen, which is 1280 by 720 screen at 294 DPI.
Size of the screen?
Yeah, 1280 by 720.
No, what's the physical size of the screen? What's it, like 2 inches, 3 inches?
5 inches.
Okay.
So, I mean, this thing looks really slick, and it reminded me of initially when I first saw this, I'm like, well, this is basically NVIDIA doing a gaming console on an Android platform is essentially kind of the same thing as the Ouya, the Kickstarter project, except this is an all-in-one gaming controller / console, and it's powered by NVIDIA, so you know that they're not going to skimp on the on the GPU.
Do you guys does this remind you guys of the N-Gage from Nokia, not 5-6 years ago?
But the N-Gage was kind of a failure, wasn't it?
Well, I mean, this hasn't launched yet, so we don't know what this is going to be. No, I'm just saying in terms of the ambition of having
mobile phone being the N-Gage was what they called the taco, wasn't it? Wasn't that the one that like was kind of the shape like a taco?
Yeah, it was funnily shaped.
What was the N-Gage again?
The N-Gage was a Nokia device, and it was a cell phone, but on the top, it was sort of like a trapezoid with the screen and button and buttons being the screen in the middle. And it had, you know, console controller buttons on either side of the screen. So your phone was your game console. It was like this is like the N-Gage. Then the N-Gage was like an Atari Lynx or a Sega, a Sony PlayStation Portable. That's what it was trying to be. A telephone that was also a game console. It sounds like NVIDIA is making a dedicated game console in the same sort of way, but on this mobile hardware that many telephones use.
Yeah, this should be interesting. One of the questions that I posed before we started recording here was, like, I couldn't find anything on here about storage, so I don't know how the games are getting into the device.
It's got to be wireless. I mean, in this day and age, to sell UMDs or other kinds of like cartridges, it just doesn't work. It's too expensive, especially when iOS has already laid out the paradigm for the system. You know what I mean? Like iOS has already said, you'll download your game, you'll like it. And I feel like that's the best way to get your updates, get new features. It's got to be. It's got to be.
And supposedly, the controller can work as a standalone controller as well. I don't know, although in conjunction with what system, I'm not entirely sure.
The Ouya.
But it says doesn't include an LTE radio, so it's Wi-Fi only, running Jelly Bean, but that may change by the time it's expected to ship in quarter 2, 2013. No word on pricing. So who knows? But this is interesting, an interesting development from NVIDIA. I'm kind of excited about this. I'm just glad. You know what it is? I'm really glad with this and with the next article that we're going to be talking about is it seems to be like there's a whole sea change away from into basically next generation computing away from the the monopoly, the stranglehold of Sony, Microsoft, and Nintendo, the big three.
Do you think that's because on some level, like these guys have had, well, it's 8 years now, right? The the seventh generation is 8 years old. The seventh generation is older than the actual generation in terms of numbers. You think on some level it's because of that, because these guys have been like, okay, there's been no innovation.
Right.
Or no. Not, I mean, I don't want to say no innovation, but like, you know, there's been.
Well, I mean, Sony, Microsoft, and for the most part, Nintendo, but mostly Sony and Microsoft. They, you know, when was the last time that they put out the PlayStation 3 and the Xbox 360 are how old now?
They're 8 years old.
Yeah. So, yeah. And they actually do well. I mean, I have no complaints about them as gaming systems. The games that that you can play on them are still fairly state-of-the-art games. I don't feel any significant difference between the state-of-the-art games that you can play on the PS3 and the state-of-the-art games you can play on a standalone PC. There may be a difference there, but if so, it's
minimal.
Yeah, it's minimal. So I feel like this is these developments, such as Project Shield and the Steam the Valve box, Steam box that we're going to be talking about, are addressing like a different need entirely than the need. It's not like they're fulfilling a need that the PS3 and the Xbox are not fulfilling. It's like they're addressing a completely different sort of need. I'm not entirely sure what that is.
Well it's actually really...
Oh, you go first, sure.
Oh, I was just saying it's actually kind of interesting to... When you look at it and you see that on Kickstarter, there are all these other corporations who are now starting to get into... the console market, right? Mm-hmm. There are quite a few ones. Was the Ouyo one?
Right.
Yeah.
There's also another one which I actually just saw today. It's slipping my mind right now, but it was more of a kind of a joystick. I'll look it up at some point. Uh-huh. But I mean, it seems like a lot of these organizations are trying to get in with more so like, some
like oh, OnLive. Is OnLive what you mean? The one with the
No, it's not. It's not OnLive. It's another Kickstarter, which is ongoing, which is basically a smaller console. It's supposed to play Android games. It's mm-hmm. just kind of like a gamepad and a small like a USB stick.
Oh,
type
I
thing.
Think I know what you're talking about. Yeah, I think I've seen that project as well. Yeah, but it's you're right. It's
Game Stick. That's what it's called.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So it's a lot of. It's really interesting to see. The turn of the century that there are all these players, but everyone knows, like everyone who is interested in games knows that end of this year or next year is when you may expect some the serious competition. So that's the Microsoft and the Sony's, and to see what direction they want to take the market. So it's really interesting, and I'm not necessarily sure. When this announcement actually came up, I heard a lot of from a lot of the gamers who I know, there was basically groans across the world in terms of like, is this really what we want? So I'd have to see a lot from it to see stick-to-itiveness in there and see people go out and actually spend money on that.
Part of me is just trying to figure out what gamers want. Like, I know for me, and I'm not a super hardcore gamer, I want to be able to play a game on my console, leave my house, pull out my phone, and maybe not continue to play the same game because the hardware is clearly diminished from a dedicated console, but to play something that affects my game, a game within a game, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Like when you're playing StarCraft 2 and you can go play like a Galaga or whatever, that kind of thing. Something that affects the outcome of my game, maybe levels me up, maybe like fixes a skill, you know, hones it or something like that. You know, like something that's tied into it. I want that portability. Right now, even with iOS, you know, there's Game Center, but there's only one game I have where everything is parity, or maybe two games I have where everything's parity, meaning that, like, if I pull out my iPad and start to play the game, it's exactly where I left off when I was on my iPhone. So I get that. I'm Walking at home. Dead. I'm going to use my iPad. I'm outside. I'm going to use my iPhone. I'm not losing off. I'm not losing any level level ability, things like that. There's only one game. It's like, you know, I think it's Pocket Planes and maybe Infinity Blade allow for that.
Walking Dead is like that as well.
Oh, is it? I haven't really gotten into that one yet. So I want that, but with a console. I want that ability with a console. I want to be able to walk out of my house. And even with the PSP, I know that there's at least one game that they're doing that with. But I know also with
the Vita, PlayStation Vita.
Yeah, the Vita and the PSP. The Vita and the PlayStation 3. They have they've got something tied into that. But there's also now with Portal and Valve allows you to play on your computer and play on your console, which is kind of exciting. But again, that's not as mobile. The laptop is while portable, isn't as mobile as these things. And I feel like that's the ecosystem challenge that the game consoles have.
Yeah, I was just going to bring that up. I think that, you know, one reason why I think companies like NVIDIA are getting into this is, I mean, so NVIDIA makes high-end graphics cards and high-end graphics and powering stuff, and they want to be getting into this mobile world anyway. I think their thought process is, hey, we got to build 90% of this technology for other people anyway. Maybe we'll get lucky, it'll take off. Even if not, you know, we can go to Nintendo and Microsoft and Sony and any other, mobile gaming maker and say, hey, look at our hardware can do. You should use our stuff as the basis.
Yeah, that's a really good point. It's the Intel TV shit too, right? It's like, we make the shit inside. Let's try our hand at making the whole shebang.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. But I think there's also a realization that, like, I think the big players are a little, like, gaming has really changed. Like, you know, we talk about what gamers want. There's a deeper question of what are gamers anymore? Like, you know, there's a huge amount of gaming that happens on mobile now. Especially for, like, more 8-bit style sort of casual games. I mean, that's where I primarily go for gaming. Just because it's there and it's powerful and it's easy to pick up. Nintendo has sort of always known that. It's sort of why they did such a... They've always dominated on the mobile market. You know, like if you looked at like Nintendo's DS plus Game Boy back in the day when they had Game Boy and their main console, they were by far and away the biggest gaming creator, and that's how they built their empire on that. And they honestly have probably the most to lose from this, because you know, who's going to go out and buy a DS Nintendo when you have an amazing array of games right there on your phone. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there's this problem where although, like, it's great to have that, like, phone games kind of suck still. Like, you're basically limited to tapping. Like, anything involving, like, changing directions or, like, looking or, like, anything more than, like... You know, that's why there's so many games that are basically, like, press... You know, tap the screen at the right time.
It's tap the screen, right? It's an annoying tilt crap, and I can't play a game where you can. We have to, like, I can't fly a ship where I have to tilt my screen. It's too much work. It's too much.
I agree.
They have this new. I saw this one thing, and I'm sorry that I don't have the name, but the company's a startup, and what they've done is you plug your iPhone into this dock, and the dock itself is the console button hardware. The idea is that the games are written with the API to make use of this dock. So if you spend $30-$40 on this dock, you know, for all the games that have taken advantage of these available APIs, you can then use buttons to, you know, shoot and target and block. And, you know, you have a better gaming experience. Now, you know, especially because iPhone just changed docks and all that stuff.
Right.
Who knows how much that's going to take off. But, I mean, like, that's the only real solution for the mobile gaming if you want to get serious about the actual gaming, I feel like. There's not a lot of, you know, the whole tapping thing. Like, I play Jetpack Surfer, Jetpack Joyride, and like Subway Surfer, and all these games. Mm-hmm. And really, it's like the only reason why these games can work for me is because I don't have to worry about like the double tap problem when I'm playing Galaxy of whatever.
Yeah.
Galaxy on Fire or whatever, which is annoying. It doesn't work.
Yeah.
All right. Let's move on here. So, another news, we were talking about it briefly here. Valve has partnered with hardware maker XI3 on a modular computer codenamed Piston, modeled after the XI3's X7A line of pint-sized computers. The Piston is one of many prototypes they're showing off at CES as a spec model for Valve's Steambox, which is their big picture compatible console. Piston will offer up to 1 terabyte of internal storage. The XI3 would not discuss the price point for Piston, but it commented that Steambox is based on the X7A, which is priced at $999. The demo unit of Piston features an I/O board boasting 1 Ethernet port, 1/8-inch audio in and out, SPDIF optical audio, 4 USB 3 points, 4 USB 2 points with 1 dedicated keyboard input, 4 eSATA P ports, 2 mini display ports, and 1 display port HDMI port. Now, you know,
$999.
Yes. Yes.
As a guesstimate. Yeah, way too much.
Yeah. Can get a PS3 for, I mean, it started at $500, right? $500, $600. It was $600 a PS3 when it started. And that was a steep price for getting anyone who was not a hardcore gamer into the market. So for the Steambox, $999, especially when you can, you know, build a computer that can run Steam games, mm-hmm. for $999, mm-hmm. and get some serious mileage out of that and do incremental upgrades, I just don't see that as being a great point right now. They're gonna have to get that price down.
Yeah, maybe they'll surprise us with the price. But this is also another announcement with, I saw lots of yawns. I mean, on one hand, cool for being able to potentially connect it to, you know, like a bigger screen TV, have a condensed box, but mm-hmm. a lot of the people who are already dedicated to Steam have a suitable enough computer, at least for sure. Just using for computing and for Steam, right? Yeah. And I don't know how many people are that interested in spending that amount of cash for a device. Hasn't Valve learned? People love Steam sales, and we'll go crazy over Steam sales.
Yeah, is there something in here about the idea that they're trying to open up their market to like people who don't want to build a geek a super box?
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. I mean, do you think that this sort of solution would be marketed towards someone who wanted like a turnkey, essentially a console system, but specifically for big picture? For
yeah, Steam? I mean, I like computer games more than I like console games. I'll just say that out loud. Yeah. So part of me is thinking that if I can have a spec-based Steam box that allows me to do that computer gaming, you know, on my big screen, get the best of both worlds, then yeah, there's something worth that. Mm-hmm. $999, $1,000 is not worth that to me right now. Mm-hmm. But if they can get that price down, I would think about that. Because, you know, as laptops move ever toward thin and light, you know, there's some performance to be had with a MacBook Air and some of the Ultrabooks, but the gaming rig is something that is bigger than that. And if Steam can get that kind of power out of something that is dedicated to kind of a console-like experience, mm-hmm. And I can still use my mouse and keyboard, there's definitely value in that. I just don't know if that value is sitting at $1,000. I think it's sitting somewhere between $400 and $600.
I was really surprised to hear like a price named at all. I mean, usually I feel like at CES, well, it's just sort of like idea when it's going to come out, yeah. No idea what the price is going to be, no idea on anything. I mean, like, who says prices at CES? Like, usually what happens at CES is like rumors that it might come out at this time for this price point, and it comes out 6 months later for twice as much.
Well, technically, like, this isn't the price point of this device. They wouldn't name a price point. They just suggested that it might be similar to an already existing product that they've had out.
Okay. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. I think you're right, Chris. CES kind of to me stands for concept electronics show, not consumer electronics show, because it's like, hey, here's what's capable. Look at my super 4K TV or 8K TV. And they, you know, the yawns happen, and like, yeah, we're not going to make this because we realized it costs X amount of dollars. Like, there have been Retina displays, displays for computers before, specifically like ridiculous like 4K video monitors for computers, but they never sold. But they were at CES again because they're like, look what we can do, and it's kind of like the Halo product space for. It used to be the Halo products for the Halo space for a lot of like. Bigger brands, and I feel like now what CES has become is more of a concepts for bigger brands and a place for younger brands like the Pebble guys or whatever to make big announcements and, mm-hmm. and get their name on the
as the CEO at Box said on Twitter, CES people travel from all over to play with gadgets and not buy anything, not to be confused with Best Buy.
yeah so I also feel like, you know, there was a guy, it was on NPR today, the guy was talking about how his company, he's the guy who's got the nano coating for the inside of the telephone, they those guys, you know, they got their product, they showed up at CES, and it was only until they showed up at CES that people people started noticing what they had, what they were able to offer, after their CES exposure, they were all over Engadget and The Verge and any other publication you'd love to be on if you're a tech company. And now they're finally going to be shipping. They're working with a company. They didn't say which one, so that they can ship their technology in a phone out the box instead of you having to send it into them or whatever. So CES does work for those tiny. This company's out of Utah. It's got like 20 people, 40 people. So. You know, there's like room for growth here. It's just not this quite the same. So I think Chris is right. It's not. It's like who drops prices. It's more about like, look what I can do.
Yeah. That being said, it's pretty exciting to see Steam like expand out. You know, like they, I think, really have a sense of their business. Like, and they have a sense that there is a lot bigger market for them than just being a. You know, place to pick up sort of cool indie games and do Steam sales, you know? I think they want to be, you know,
the
face of gaming. Yeah, exactly. And they realize that they're in that place. And it's cool. It's cool to see a very different approach to – I mean, they're very unique, honestly, as a company. You know, they're not – really a game studio. They're not really a software company. They're not really a hardware company.
Is Steam no longer owned by Valve? I thought Steam was owned by Valve.
No. Well, that's my point. Like, yeah, they are owned by Valve. So they are sort of a software hardware gaming company, but very different from how most game companies make their money.
Blizzard, Activision, all those guys. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think that on some level, they have to do this. And the reason they have to do this is because let's look at the landscape, guys. I'm talking on the drill down on my iPhone. Meanwhile, I'm looking at some of the stuff on my iPhone and my iPad. I don't have a computer with me, even though I'm Skyping. I didn't use my computer once when I was away for 2 weeks, because between my iPhone and my iPad, I had everything I needed in terms of connectivity. The idea of the gaming rig that plays the Steam games, the idea of the hardcore desktop replacement Alienware laptop, that's kind of moving away. And if they want to survive, they've got to find a way to, I don't know how to use this word, but appliance size, make their hardware run on an appliance rather than a dedicated box if they want.
I don't know if that's necessarily going away. I think there's still going to be that circle of users who've been there since, you know, the 90s,
yeah.
The 80s.
Exactly. It's a niche, though. If they want to expand, they're going to have to find a way to make it an appliance. Also, those guys, girls in the 80s and the 90s, they're having children now. They don't have time to maintain a gamer box and buy that new NVIDIA card. If I know that the standard is the standard, and I'm a game maker, and I make things for that standard, I'm going to make more games. If I know that I don't have to worry about drivers this and drivers that. Right, I know that these are the standards, and Valve and NVIDIA have worked it out together or whatever.
And I actually think the PC gaming market is actually on a rise. I think I was reading some articles late last year, because there were articles before that saying PC gaming is down. But I think a lot of the popular titles are definitely things which are also, of course, released on the PC. And a lot of the innovative indie things, too, as well. But I definitely agree with you in the sense that this is a move they need to do to increase their market hold. Mm-hmm. But of course, in doing so, I will wait till they give a suitable price.
Yeah, I see, like the 30-somethings, right? Like you've got your Chris. You just got married. You know, in 18 months or whatever, he might think about having a kid or something like that. If he's a PC gamer, there's not a lot of time for games in general, much less the sort of like, does my box have what it takes? So I need to upgrade my box kind of stuff. And I think that's where Steam is smart, because if they want to, obviously, if you still want to do your classic gaming layout, then you know, you got it. But if you want more of a like what Andy said, a key turn approach, then you've got that too. It makes a lot of sense.
Let us move on to our final story here. The Pebble smartwatch is best known for being a smash hit on Kickstarter. It broke records and leapt to a total of 85,000 orders by the time the campaign ended. The only thing left to do was ship, but unfortunately the company quietly announced a pair of delays that left an actual ship date in limbo, an unfortunately common problem with Kickstarter campaigns, don't I know it. Today at CES, the CEO, Eric Migakovsky, announced that the company now has a firm shipping date for its backers, January 23rd. It will go out in batches, Migakovsky says, and it only recently ramped up to full production in its factory in China, producing around 15,000 of the watches each week. I personally am a backer of this, so I should be getting mine sometime after the 23rd.
Likewise. Yay.
Same here. Yeah, I'm excited.
Oh, you got one too? Awesome.
Oh, yeah. They could not fail with Steam. With Steam. Huh?
Kickstarter?
They could not fail. Like, if they failed on this Kickstarter program, mm-hmm. then Kickstarter would see a lot of repercussions. Like, Kickstarter itself. If the biggest Kickstarter ever...
Yeah.
Or like a headline in Kickstarter failed, yeah. then, you know, it would call into question this idea of investing everything. And I think mm-hmm. that I don't know if there was any help from Kickstarter on the backside, because the PR fallout would be terrible if they didn't make it or not. But I think that they've done a very good job of giving us the updates, even though we're like, oh, email from Pebble. Oh, it's not being shipped yet. Still, we're getting the updates. We understand the problem. They've done a really good job of that. And I think that, I'm excited to see the product. I guess the only thing I'm worried about is that, you know, I expected in September, these manufacturing processes have undoubtedly exposed to them a whole new set of features and awesomeness that they're yeah. going to put in version 2, which who knows might come out within, you know, a couple months. If my iPad 2 or 3 experiences anything, you know, I'm just worried that a new Pebble 2 will show up right as I get into the groove with my Pebble. So that's my only, like, concern, worry, whatever. But other than that, I'm really excited.
Yeah, no, I'm super excited. I definitely – so the thing which – I think one of the reasons which I actually invested in the Pebble as well mm-hmm. is because the same organization had already done a previous watch. So this wasn't their first round at the rodeo.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I'm full of them today. but – you know, due to the scale, I think they definitely managed it really well in terms of providing updates, providing images. This is what led me – I think this is definitely one of the most comfortable Kickstarters that I've had. Mm-hmm. Even the other ones which I've had, it's really all about giving that presence and showing that you are in control and that you actually have a plan. I think that probably – I'm sure there's a lot of people who may have been disappointed not to get it before the holidays, but at least getting these – particular updates. And then, you know, same thing with CES, they added more features that we weren't expecting, right?
Yeah.
Did you guys read any of those? The ambient light sensors and
and the magnetometer, so it'll have like a built-in compass. It's got a magnetic charging cable, so that allows for a 5 atmosphere water resistance rating, which will allow you to, you know, wash your dishes while wearing your watch if you want to do that. And the built-in accelerometer allows you to tap or flick your wrist to turn on the backlight, which is pretty slick as well.
That's pretty cool. That's pretty weird, though. Can you see people like, oh, yeah, what are you doing? Yeah, like, are you shocked? Like, what happened? No, I just turned on my backlight. Just touch the watch.
Yeah. Well, that's cool, though. It's cool to be able to, like, do stuff without, you know, touching it.
Yeah, and these are all features we weren't expecting. So
right.
These are all, like, the creme de la creme.
Along the way, throughout the whole development of this Kickstarter, Pebble kept adding and adding features and updating and adding, which is unexpected, unheard of. I mean, if only every consumer manufacturer were this generous with products for their consumers.
Yeah, I don't know if you guys saw the interview that The Verge had with this guy, but he did mention that. He mentioned that they wanted to, like, you know, add features as they went forward. He also mentioned that the reason that the watch faces are there is in many ways because it's for them a test to make sure that the software development kit is working properly. So the watch faces, it's kind of like a trivial thing, right? Oh, which watch face am I going to use?
Right.
The whole thing behind that is that it was the most expedient and feature camera friendly way to lay out the SDK was working. Which is why they're like a million watch faces. Which to me is I like that kind of like the necessity makes a bit of culture. You know, kind of like when you watch Battlestar Galactica and the corners of all the pages are cut off because it's a metaphor about how they had to cut corners on the budget.
Right.
That kind of. Anyway, I thought that was interesting. The interview was very funny in some ways because the guy giving the interview is sort of like super hipster geek chic, like, yeah. And the young man who's like, you know, the CEO who's like talking is like kind of sheepish and shy, like, yeah, so I want to do this and that, and I think it's gonna be great, and I'm excited we're gonna be getting it out, and I'm confident. And it's just like the dynamic is just sort of like, I don't know, I laughed a lot.
I have not checked that out, but I definitely will.
It's like 5 minutes, 18 seconds.
Okay. Anything else before we wrap up the show for the evening?
By the way, did you guys see any of the Qualcomm announcement at all?
I read about it on The Verge about what a train wreck that announcement was, but I didn't actually see it.
Yes, there is a shortcut video which I can link to you guys. It is,
is it a hot mess?
It is more than a hot mess.
It's like an embarrassment of an attempt to be hip marketing sort of push on Qualcomm's part, right? That's what I got, kind of the upshot of it that I gathered.
Yes, they try and be hip. They try and be old school to a certain extent. They try and be teenagers to a certain extent, and it's just it makes you really question life. it really makes you question. You like go back to the drawing board, and like some of my colleagues were saying, well, either they're really brilliant because they know everyone's going to be talking about them now, or they're just missing it. You know, it's not. I'm not really sure which way it is. It was, you know, we've all seen our share of messy conferences, and this one takes the cake and is definitely going to be a memorable one. So I'll make sure I link it for viewers, link the short little clip of it. But I hear the full show is quite amusing. It's really funny because this was also the same day as the NCAA championship in football. And the game was a bit out of hand, and so while that game was a bit out of hand, all throughout Twitter it was spreading the Qualcomm the actual keynote and telling people to tune in and be like, if you're looking for something even more crazy, watch this. And it was just really viral. It was kind of interesting to see it as such a train wreck, which many people couldn't turn away.
Wow, so that is a scathing review of this announcement. I gotta look at it just for the horrificness.
Now I feel like I missed out not seeing it. I heard similar things about the NVIDIA announcement. I heard rumors on Twitter that like the NVIDIA announcement was super creepy. And I
didn't get a chance to see it. I mean, mainly I heard a lot of people be like, "Oh, not another game cloud integration." Okay. So I heard there was a lot of naysay about that, but I didn't really didn't get a chance to view that one yet.
Okay.
All right. Well, let's go around the table here, and I'll start with you, Dwayne. Where can we find you when you're not on the drill down?
You can find me on twitter.com/DwayneD. That's DWAYNED. You can also find what I'm doing at flavors.me/DwayneD. And that's all.
And Chris, how about yourself? Where can we find your work online?
You can find all my tweets and blogs at chrisbernor.com and at chrisbernor, respectively. On Mondays and Fridays, I curate a list of startup events in Silicon Valley and startup-related articles and whatnot in that is worldwide at startupdigest.com.
And finally, Tosin, where can we find your work online when you're not here on the drill down?
You can find me at twitter.com/toast4321, so toast like the bread, 4321, as well as you can find me rambling on about random things and movies at the ircwebcast.blogspot.com.
How's that webcast going?
It's even ridiculous as ever. We last night we did movie commentary for the film Snatch, and we had a couple people who had never seen Snatch before on the podcast. So
that's blasphemous. They haven't seen Snatch?
Yeah, I was very surprised, but delighted to really hear their first experience.
Was anyone else sad that there's no third Guy Ritchie, London-based petty gangster film?
I think his work has declined exponentially since he started directing. So not that crazy about him anymore.
I love how quickly you said that. I just meant like, you know, like Lock, Stock came out, and then what? 3 years later, Snatch came out, or something like that. I just kind of wish that within three years, while it was still good, before the whole Madonna situation, he had made just one more, so we could have like the Lock, Stock, like the unofficial trilogy that like Wong Kar-wai has, or like Sergio Leone has. You know what I mean? It's the same story over and over again. Same two actors, just different scenario.
I think other people since those two movies, other directors have done it as good, if not better. Like what's his name? The guy who did Layer Cake, you name it. As for myself, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com or gplus.to, MrBabyMan. That's my Google Plus link. I'm also starting a new podcast, which should be out by the time this one is out on Friday of this week. And it's called the Parageekology Podcast. And it's essentially a geek take on paranormal activity. So me and a couple of other co-hosts are going to be exploring paranormal events and our geek take on it. It's a very niche podcast. I'll fill more people in as we get a couple of other podcasts under our belt. This is our initial podcast, so first one's a little rough. This one we discuss demon possession. So I'll let you guys know how things turn out as more of these episodes roll out.
Demon possession from the geek perspective? So you mean like as a geek what you'd love it to be, or as a geek what science tells us it is? Or both?
A little bit of both. Like my particular sort of a perspective on pretty much everything that we're going to be covering is I look at it from the perspective of applying Occam's razor to the paranormal event, whatever it is. Is that I'm pretty much a hardcore skeptic, and I'm always looking for the logical explanation in whatever it is that we're going to be exploring. So
that sounds awesome. Congrats.
Thanks. You can check out.
I'm skeptical of your skepticism.
Well, we'll see. I've told them. I've said, you know, I'm not willing to believe anything unless I see it firsthand with my own eyes or experience it firsthand. So,
Andrew Scully Sorcini.
Yeah, seriously. I want to believe, though. I really do, but you got to prove it to me. You can check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com, and our iTunes link is in the upper right-hand sidebar. And if you subscribe to us on iTunes, write us a review, rate us, give us a good rating if you like us, give us some feedback. Our show is on Stitcher. Listen to us on your iPhone, Android phone, Kindle Fire, and other devices. Go to Stitcher.com and do a search for The Drill Down. Facebook.com/TheDrillDown. Twitter.com/TheDrillDown. If you got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about, tweet us or email us at comments@TheDrillDown.com. If you got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@TheDrillDown.com for us to publish on the site. Let us help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Happy 2013.